It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
The wage gap for female full-time year-round workers is 80% of their male counterparts. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Faced with these statistics, one survey found that 40% of women say they feel overwhelmed when thinking about their finances, and 31% say they feel discouraged. Salisbury University held a conference on women and money this week to deal with some of the issues facing them in these economically turbulent times. In our studio this morning are Jessica Eisman, a financial advisor and area women inclusion leader at Edward Jones. Also, Annette Johnson, a women's leadership coach and author who has joined Salisbury University's Office of Diversity and Inclusion, as well as Mary Angela Baker, director of the Extended and Lifelong Learning. Welcome to the program, all.
Thank you.
So I want to start with, let me start with Annette there. So I was looking at statistics in terms of the kinds of problems that women face. And aside from the wage gap, that since leads to a lot of other problems as well in terms of trying to figure out about retirement, trying to, say, for instance, deal with student loans and so on. Give me an overall picture of what we're looking at for women in America.
Well, I think it's interesting here in this new century and 2020 that we're even still having the conversation. So as someone who is working in the diversity, equity, belonging, and inclusion space, what's important to me is that women are paid for the work that they do. Right. So making sure that there's equity. And like you said, that does touch everything. It affects how much I can save. It affects how much I can invest. It affects my, you know, lifestyle, how I can live. So until we address that and look at the equity and pay, it's going to continue to affect all of those other areas for women.
So, I mean, one of the things that struck me is that, particularly for retirement, it seems to have a dramatic impact when it comes to the amount of money that they might have. They have much less, for instance, than, say, men do have. Tell me a little bit about that. What kind of impact that has?
Well, you have to look at discretionary funds, right? So how much money after I meet my basic needs of paying rent or mortgage, childcare, which childcare fees are just through the roof these days, how much can I save? It's easy to say put 10% of your salary aside, but if that 10% is going to impact putting food on the table or paying, keeping a roof over my head or paying for childcare, how do I do that?
So one of the things the stats, as a matter of fact, struck me is that women who are 65 and older, they're twice as likely to live in poverty.
Yes.
I mean, what does that mean? How do women get along then?
As best they can. As best they can. It's a real struggle. I have a personal situation, a woman who's 52 years old, her children are adults, and she is trying to live off of $32,000 a year. It's not easy. And trying to save and prepare for retirement at 52.
So one of the things, of course, is how do we deal with this, particularly with women in terms of they deal with the fact that they're not making as much money. I want to turn to you, Jessica. And what do you advise women when they come to you or when they're looking at their finances? Because as I indicated a moment ago, there's some that are simply either overwhelmed or even discouraged.
I would say it's never too late to get started. So if you haven't began a plan, if you don't have a plan, get that in place first. And then begin to create partnerships with professionals that will help you implement that plan and stay on track.
So what kinds of things that we're talking about?
So as far as everyone's situation is going to be different. But if there needs to be a disciplined approach to budgeting, or figuring out what's important to you. Some people, it just takes a little bit longer to be able to design a future plan of what's most important to them. And then once they are able to set that in place, then they'd have a plan to be able to get there. Start with a budget. Maybe it's they want to send the kids to college. Maybe it's that they're saving for retirement. Maybe they have some other goals in mind. But creating a plan to get there is the first step.
So one of the things I've been talking about is getting professional help. How often do women seek professional help, do you think?
Actually, women value advice traditionally more than men. But they don't always take the time to do that. They're torn in so many different directions as wives and mothers and professionals in many cases that they don't necessarily take the time that it takes. Many people spend much more time planning family vacations than they do planning for their own retirement. This is concerning because they need a plan, especially women need a plan.
So if they're looking for professional help, what do they look for? I mean, there are a lot of professional planners out there, but not all are reputable.
So as far as what you look for in a professional advisor, I would say look for somebody that you can connect with. Look for somebody that you can trust. Look for somebody whose values are similar to yours. Look for somebody that's going to take the time to understand your situation completely before giving you advice.
So the other idea is that this idea about balancing one's goals with one's spouse. How does one negotiate that, especially in a situation where these days, oftentimes people will get divorced?
Well, we talk about that frequently, about how that can money can begin many arguments between spouses. And I would say the first part is, I believe it all comes down to sort of a misunderstanding between spouses, where a female or wife or mother may serve as the chief financial consumer in a household. They are oftentimes responsible for the goods and services that come into the home and provide for the children and things like that. However, it may appear to others as if they're spending all of the money. It can be misinterpreted. The woman may feel like she's providing what is necessary for her family. And so there can be a misunderstanding. So having a goal, a plan in place, maybe sitting down with a financial advisor to drive home the importance of why save, how to save, and then create that plan to get there is probably the most important thing to achieve that goal.
Is there tension, do you think, that sometimes to sit down between man and wife in terms of trying to figure out where they're going?
Absolutely. So where they're going doesn't always, might not always agree on that. What's important to one may not be important to another, but compromise is always in. It can always be a part of that. And sometimes that's easier when there's a third party involved. It's, you can have those discussions at home, every day. But until you have a third party in there saying, have you thought about, what if we did this? Maybe we're able to achieve everyone's goals and everyone's objectives in this process.
Do you think, Jessica, it's also having a conversation of what's important and what a person's values are? And I'm thinking about if a husband wants to retire on the beach in a little house and the spouse wants to be in the city in a condo, that's the first conversation that you'd want to have and to say, this is what's important to me, this is where I see us together, and move forward for there, and to say, before we can create a plan, we have to know where we're going and what we're doing.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think it's also, these are conversations I have with my daughters now who are adults. It's like, who's the spender and who's the saver? And who's the one who is, who's the person who's good at putting together a budget and managing the budget? Yeah. Because I think you have to start with the skill set, right? And the person who has the discipline to be able to manage the money as well. So I wouldn't want to put the budget and the finances in the hands of the person who likes to shop. It spends a lot of time at the mall.
True.
Well, how does one then, for instance, not all couples stay together. So how do you keep that in the back of your mind? I mean, people don't go in saying, oh, I'm going to get split up with my spouse down the road. But there is that thing that looms out there that's a potential. How do women protect themselves from being, at the end of the marriage, being out of luck?
Absolutely. It's really important. As Annette said, that, we don't want, the spender necessarily to be in charge of all the finances, because they might not have any after that. But everyone should be at that table having that conversation about the inflow and the outflow of money, because what if something were to happen? And it could be divorce, or it could be the unexpected. What if one were to pass away? Women are 3 times more likely than men to be widowed. Those conversations should happen. What if the unexpected happens, and how can we prepare?
And how do people balance, say, for instance, their planning in terms of their children's education? Education is becoming more and more expensive. People are certainly taking out college loans, which I always remind my students that when I graduated, I had no debt, and it cost me maybe $100 to $200 to attend a state university. No longer. How does one deal with trying to plan, on the one hand, to give your children a good education, but yet, on the other hand, you have to think about what you're going to be doing in terms of your own cash flow?
Right. I get this question a lot. How do I maintain my lifestyle? How do I budget all of these things while trying to prepare, you know, to save for my children's college education in addition to my own retirement? In a lot of those situations, I say you have to put the mask on yourself first. There's one thing in life that you can't borrow money for, and that's to say, I'm going to retire. Could you give me some money to do that? Students are able to take out loans for their education. So I would say, start with retirement in mind, and if you're able to help your children, great.
That's interesting, because I received two messages around that, around college education for both my daughters, and one was from financial planners, and they said, don't do it. Don't spend your retirement money on college education. Let them take out loans. But then I looked at it from a different lens. One, my parents would have never been able to have a conversation with me about paying for my education. My husband and I were in a situation where we could afford to pay for our children's education, and we decided we did not want them to come out with six-figure debt, making a $50,000 a year job. Right. Most people are coming out of college and they're not even hitting the 40s, let alone 50s, and so it would take them a lifetime to pay that off. So we made a conscious decision to let our retirement account take that hit. I don't know if it was the right thing to do or not. In my heart, it felt like the right thing to do, because I just didn't want them to start their lives off as adults being in debt.
But I'm going to be the devil's advocate here. If there is a situation where a divorce happens, and according to the government, women's household income on average falls 41% with a divorce, I like your comment of putting the mask on first. I kind of look at it from the big picture. I would rather have these women taking care of themselves for their future, and if they can then help their children. So you were able to do
That's the difference. We could afford it. Yeah. So if we could not afford it, it would have been a very different right. conversation.
And you had two working parents, which impacts yes. the income coming in.
Yeah.
The situation is going to be different for each family. Mm-hmm. And that yeah. question is around debt oftentimes. Do I take care of all of my debt, student loans, whatever mm-hmm. it may be, before I move into either saving for retirement or saving for my children's education or both? In that situation, I can't answer that question mm-hmm. because it's so individual based mm-hmm. on the circumstances. Mm-hmm. It just depends.
Well, how much impact is there in terms of trying to save retirement on the one hand, and yet you may have graduated from college, but you got this enormous debt, whether it's the six figure or not. I mean, you got to pay off the debt. I mean, I know some younger people who say, I'm still paying it off. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think Barack Obama, I think, said that he finally got it done, you know, mm-hmm. when he was like in his 40s. Mm-hmm. How do you balance? I mean, how do you figure out? I mean, is college worth it? I mean, on one level, in terms of the debt that you get, in terms of whether or not you're going to be able to retire.
I think absolutely worth it, because the research shows that people with college degrees long-term make more money than people without a college degree. Sure, you're going to have the few millennials or few Gen X who are coming in and getting a high-tech job right when they're 20 years old and they make a lot of money. They're the exception. Mm-hmm. I think for the most part, and as a lifelong learner advocate, you're going to have to keep going to school. You're going to have to keep on keeping your skills up to date, because the jobs of the future don't exist now. And if you don't keep training and learning and acquiring new skills, you're going to be in one of those positions where you're going to be 60 years old and no one will hire you.
And there's been a shift, right? So about 15 years ago, maybe 15 to 20 years ago, it's like the undergrad degree became the high school diploma in professional jobs. Now it's shifted even more so. It's you look at the job requirements, and most job requirements now, they'll say undergrad required, but master's graduate degree preferred. And that means we want the graduate degree. So, you know, things are continuing to shift. So for me, it was making sure that my daughters were prepared to compete for the types of jobs that they said that they were interested in, and to be able to use the resources that we had and that we could afford to use to position them to do that.
I also think a lot of young people are still living at home, and they're paying off their debt rent because they're doing rent free. So they're making arrangements with their parents to say, okay, I'm 25 years old. I'm going to stay living at home. You know, the whole thing about being in your basement, but I'm still living at home. And that gives me the opportunity to spend more of my personal income in paying off my debt.
Mm-hmm. What about the woman who decides to stay home as a homemaker? What happens to what kind of advice do you give her? I mean, she doesn't have any money coming in outside of her husband.
I would say for her to definitely understand her situation and the how that's going to impact the future. It's not only today's income, but over time, that's a huge commitment and one that's very important. I was fortunate to be able to stay home with my children for a couple of years, but not only does that impact your salary and your advancement and your years in the workforce as far as Social Security, but also your ability to save over that period of time. And every situation, again, is going to be different. But I would say just be aware of your situation and how that could impact your future, not just today's budget and finances.
But that speaks to, I think, a myth that's out there that in order for you to be financially savvy and educated and you know, understand wealth management and financial management, that you have to have a certain job or make a certain amount of money, or you have to have a certain amount of money. And it doesn't mean that at all. I think it's important to educate yourself and be aware, regardless of whether you are a full-time work-at-home mom or you're a CEO. You know, the importance of it doesn't change regardless of your position.
Because, I mean, one of the things that struck me is that it seems as if the one who stays home and takes care of the household is disappearing for a whole host of reasons, both financial as well as technological. But you get women who, like, take some time off to say they have some children, and then they may get back to the workforce in maybe 5 or 10 years or whatever time they decide to take off. That's got to have an impact on their planning in terms of retirement and how they save, how they financially plan.
Absolutely.
But you know, so I'm sorry, I don't mean to cut you off.
Go ahead.
But the other thing, when we talk about things changing, men are making those decisions too. So families are sitting down and they're saying, okay, what makes sense for our family? Right. And sometimes it makes more sense for the man to stay home because maybe the woman is making more money. And so couples are making those decisions now based off of what makes financial sense, what makes the best sense for our family at this particular moment. So you've got men in the same situation, too, where they don't have the income, but they're home. They're managing the home and they're taking care of the children. And the woman is out because she's out of the house working because she's making more money. So I think there's no one size fits all. I don't think there's like a right answer. I think you have to look at the situation and make the decision that's best for your family, given that particular time in your life. And things continue to shift and evolve constantly.
And it goes back to your point of having a plan and having a conversation, because all of this is, you know, you just can't make a plan
right.
And then let it sit there. You really do need to be having conversations as you go, and you're having a conversation of, and we please hope that no one ends up with divorce as I sit here and listen.
That's never the goal.
Never the goal. But right. Really to say, you know, as we as a family, as we're moving forward toward our mutual goals, we hope, of educating our children, of planning for retirement, of having extra money to do the things that we want to do, you know, how are we working together on this?
Yeah.
And it might be, you know, because people do get kind of tied up in a bundle, having those conversations, you know, talking to a third party, having someone that can facilitate the conversation of saying what's important to you, where are you now, where's this money going, have you created a budget? And Jessica did a workshop for us, and we were on the conversation of, do you know where your money goes each month? And do you have a spreadsheet, which can be a very easy Excel document saying, this is where where the money goes for going out for dinner, this is where mm-hmm. the money goes for childcare, or, you know, all the different things that you know, paying the mortgage, paying the the heating bill, paying the air conditioning bill, which could be huge in the summer, but really having those conversations along the line and not having it just once a year.
Right. Mm-hmm. You know, there have been studies that have shown that women are can be better investors than men. They are long-term focused. They trade less frequently. They're thoughtful decision makers, and they value professional advice. They're less likely to bet the farm on a hunch.
Well, let me ask you this: is it in this day and age, particularly for women, but I guess for both spouses, that it's important that they both somehow earn a living income during their lifetime? I mean, that neither one can afford to be like off like for their entire lifetime. That they both have to figure out how to make sure that both of them work.
Multiple streams of income is what is what I've been taught and I've heard over the years, multiple streams of income. So even if you are a full-time work-at-home mom, there still might be opportunity for you to leverage your skill or something that you're passionate about and turn that into an income stream.
So you're talking the gig economy.
Well,
GIG.
Not just gig economy, but I'm talking about the use of your own resources. So, you know, if you are creative and you like to craft, turning that into a business from your home. There are plenty of work from home businesses now that you can do. So I think it's important in today's economy to be creative, think outside the box, and try to identify multiple streams of income and be as creative with that as you can, because times have changed. You know, my mother was a cash and carry. When she became physically disabled and we had to move her into a nursing home, compared to my friends, it was nothing. It was giving away items to people that I know would appreciate them and cleaning out her apartment and moving her into her assisted living. I didn't have to dissolve anything. I didn't have to pay off debt. She was cash and carry. Never owned a credit card. You know, if she couldn't pay for it, she didn't need it. She didn't think it was important. That's what she would tell. If we don't have enough cash to buy it, then we don't need it right now. We can wait.
Well, in terms of retirement, as one plans for it, the fact of the matter is that we're talking about people who oftentimes, I mean, women have, generally speaking, oftentimes they'll have lower Social Security benefits, reduced assets, smaller pensions, that kind of thing. How do you, as a woman in the workforce, how does one make up for that blowback, as it were? Anybody?
I'm going to turn to our financial advisors because that's a really tough question.
That's a tough question.
Yeah. I mean, because you're at a disadvantage, because as a woman, you're automatically at a disadvantage right off the top, right? And so, unless you happen to wind up as a CEO or something and be very financially successful, most women are not doing that.
Well, the foundation of education in our school system isn't there. So even the basic money management skills, thank goodness for Junior Achievement and people out there, individual teachers that are taking that as a responsibility in their own classrooms. But there's not a basic money management course that's required to graduate, at least in Maryland, let alone to understand your tax filing needs and your needs for retirement planning and insurance. So if you're not exposed to this at home, you might not have that information. So I would say, you know, we need to get to that point. But until we do, I would still say it's never too late to start. So if you're in a situation where you feel like you might be behind, what are the things that should be done in order to get to where you need to be? And that could be any number of things. It could be getting a part-time job. It could be using a creative sense of method to be able to get another stream of income. Mm-hmm. But it could be more of developing that plan of, you know, what do we want? What do we value? And have that conversation with the spouse in order to make sure that you're going to be able to get to where you need to be. But I think you have to look out for yourself. I think that
absolutely
that is one big thing. Even in a relationship, like you say, many marriages end in divorce, and you don't ever expect it to happen when you get married. But if it does happen, how are you going to be able to do it on your own?
I also think that the title of our conference was Taking Charge of Your Future. And I really think that's important, that you have to look out for yourself, you have to take charge, and you have to be more creative. what I envision of the future, and I have no research to back this up, is that I think we're going to have a lot more what I call the golden girls situations. I think we're to decrease expenses, we're going to have single women who are either widowed, never married, divorced, but living in a community which lowers the cost. So living in a house, paying a share of the mortgage, the expenses, and having a community. Because another thing that we haven't even talked about here is as you get older, isolation is fatal. If you're living all by yourself in a house, that can be, it impacts your soul, it impacts your spirit. So living in a community, I really think is going to be a way that we're going to see more and more of that happening. And that will help with some of the costs. And again, it's taking charge of your future and saying, yes, this is the house I grew up in with my children. However, it really doesn't fit my needs, mm-hmm. and I have to let go of the family house and think of something different. Mm-hmm. And being flexible and being able to say, it's okay to move from being all by myself in this big house and then moving into a house with friends, colleagues, new people that you've never met before. And then that whole dynamic of what it's like to live with people that you're not related to. Mm-hmm.
Well, let me just guess along those lines, because we've been talking about the disadvantages, right? All these things, headwinds. On the other, do you think that women tend to have more support networks than, say, men?
Absolutely.
I think so. And no statistics to back it up, but I just think based on my experience in general, I find women to, you know, do more networking, building those small communities to support one another, and especially if they have similar interests. So, for example, women with small children, you know, they may have support systems. Women who have gone through divorce may have mm-hmm. single women. I mean, I hear of so many women's support groups and networks out there.
A friend of mine in Cambridge is a widow, and she belongs to an organization that's just for widows, and they go and they do social events.
Yeah, so I think, you know, we're natural born nurturers, right? And so I think we find ways to unite or connect with women with similar interests and to support each other. And I think that's a great thing.
A whole other conversation is the whole idea of having your board of advisors or your board of directors, your kitchen cabinet, and being very, again, it's being very deliberate of saying, who are the people that I reach out to? Who do I reach out for? It could be the financial support. Who do I reach out for making me laugh and giggle? Who do I reach out for? That's a sounding board that I'm saying, these are the issues I'm having at work. But again, and there is research that says that women are more successful, and I'm defining success as not only in the workplace but in life, mm-hmm. when they have people that they've identified and go to help them move forward through their life.
And I think one of the other things I admire in women is their ability to reinvent themselves. You know,
yes.
Don't be afraid to reinvent yourself, because you'll find that your skill set or your interests change over time. And so even what you're really, really good at, you can leverage that into something else. And put yourself on another path. We had that conversation earlier.
I'm a good example. I changed careers at 40.
Exactly. And so I think that's powerful, to have the courage to try something different and not be afraid to fail and stumble along the way. And just kind of, if you do, dust yourself off and keep moving forward.
Well, I do want to point out that both of you are in basically second careers. So, Jessica, just want you to say a little bit about where you started.
So I was in education for 18 years in Worcester County Public Schools. So I was a teacher, I was a counselor, I was a school principal, assistant principal. And so the more I advanced, the less I worked with students and families, the less I felt that I was having an impact. And the more I heard my father, who was an Edward Jones financial advisor, talk about his relationships with people, how he helped people, how he really felt good about making an impact in the community, I wanted to be a part of that. And so at age 40, he offered to retire and for have me take over his business. And so I was a career changer at 40, and I've never looked back.
And you went back to school and received the credentials to
Absolutely.
Do that.
Absolutely. Yep. I started all the way from the beginning, and I'm really happy that I did. I really feel that the job is right for me. I have the best job in the world. I love to help people and make an impact in my community.
So we're kind of on a little bit on the opposite side, right? So I worked for a financial services firm for 32 years. Corporate America, 32 years, took a early retirement opportunity. And my husband and I have been working on our vision for what retirement is going to look like. So one of my greatest mentors said, you know, retirement, and she does retirement training, retirement is not just the money, but what is your vision? So where do you want to live? Who do you want to be around? What do you want to see when you wake up every morning, et cetera, et cetera. And we stumbled upon our town that we live in now and decided this is it. This is he can roll out of bed and play golf. I can roll out of bed and go to the beach. So,
not bad.
And given that, I found an opportunity at Salisbury University doing diversity and inclusion work, which I've always had my hands in throughout my 30-year career, and thought, wow, this would be a great opportunity to be able to dedicate my skills and experience to that full time and just focus on that element of what I do. And so it was one of the greatest decisions we made. We downsized. We love it here and love being at Salisbury University, and it's a great time to be doing this work.
Well, let me ask you this, because there are some women who, and we see it certainly in fictional stories, about women who, like, something's happened to their husband, whatever it is, and they strike out on their own, not to simply shift to another career, but to create businesses of their own, right, from scratch, as it were, entrepreneurs, I guess. So what do you suggest that if a woman is looking at that possibility of creating, say, a job or creating a business, rather, what kind of recommendations do you have in terms of not only obviously have some initial investment, then how do you plan ahead and say, for one, this might not work out, but B, how do you cushion yourself in case it doesn't?
I would say make sure you're really, really passionate about what path you're choosing if you're going to be that entrepreneur and have a startup business. And as long as you are that passionate, you'll find a way. Taking a loan or having some initial investment in it, it's going to be necessary. And you have to plan for that and prepare for that. Also, seek professional advice. You're going to need that cabinet full of people that you can rely on in order to be able to get this to work for you. And so I would say one step at a time, have that goal in mind, have that vision planning done, but you may not have all the answers until you start putting everything in place. So.
And there's resources here in the area. So Maryland Capital Enterprises, it's a nonprofit. What they do is they help people start and sustain their business. The Small Business Administration, the SBA, same thing. They work very closely with Maryland Capital Enterprises, and they help people create the plan because, it goes back to the planning of putting down on paper or putting down on your computer screen where you want to be and then backing up to figure out how to get there. But there are resources in the area that can help with that.
And I just want to build off of what you said, Jessica, about the vision, because I think it's important. You know, we can have this idea to be an entrepreneur, and there's a lot that goes into that. So before you run down the path, everyone is not built to run a business. So I think you have to take a step back. As a woman's leadership coach, my advice would be take a step back and think about, what are my strengths? What is it that I do well? And what are the things that I need to develop further? And how does that align with what I want to do, this idea of being an entrepreneur? Because maybe what you do well will not support that idea that you have. And maybe it's the things that you don't do well that you're going to have to develop further and strengthen and get educated on before you can, go forward with that venture. So it's not just the capital, having the capital to invest. It's really about reflecting, taking a step back and saying, okay, am I built for this? You know, what am I bringing to the table that I know will help me move forward? But what are some of the things that I need to build up and strengthen to be able to sustain this and to be able to be as successful as possible?
And I would also say, use your network to find women entrepreneurs
Absolutely.
Can you introduce me to a women entrepreneur and talk with her and say, tell me about your experience, you know, what worked, what didn't work. And also, you know, as a lifelong learner, there are so many different places online that you can take free courses. The MOOC, MOOC, massive online open courses, and they have courses on accounting. They have courses on being an entrepreneur. They have coaching classes, you know, all sorts of things. But there are resources that don't cost a lot of money to learn.
But the self-awareness is the key.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
If your business requires you to be open every day at 8 o'clock and you're not a morning person, you might need to revisit that. So self-awareness is really key because you get excited in the idea of it. But the reality, it's like, oh, I don't want to work 12 hours a day or 70 hours a week. So you have to really, that self-awareness piece is really key.
Well, because one of the things that strikes me about entrepreneurship is there are really two limits, right? There's one is whatever the product is, whatever you're right to your enthusiasm, whether you're an artist or whether you're running a restaurant, right? Mm-hmm. You're really excited about. On the other hand, then there's this financial end where you're either responsible yourself or you're responsible for other people, which is a fairly hefty weight if you've ever employed anybody. So how does one make sure that they have that business sense in terms of the money and all that kind of thing that's going to go with the with the product, whatever it is that you're selling?
Well, if you don't have it, you have to get it. Mm-hmm. So it requires a lot of education. So I work around a lot of entrepreneurs who try to encourage me to go in that direction with my coaching business. I know I'm not an entrepreneur. I know that I don't want to do what's required to run a business. And I don't want to run payroll. I don't want to do any of that.
I sympathize.
So that's a problem. That would be a problem for me. So that's why I always say self-awareness is key, because you have to really know what it entails. Be educated about what it is that you're thinking about doing and going into from A to Z. Because a lot of businesses fail because people don't think about that ahead of time. And you ride through a neighborhood and you say, oh, that was a great restaurant. And it was only open for 6 months. I love that restaurant. Well, they cook great food, but they don't know how to manage a business.
And again, I go back to there are resources that are available. Maryland Capital Enterprises will sit down with you and create a business plan, and they'll look at all the different attributes and market research. You know, is this the right business for this area? Is this the right, you know, is there the audience for it? Is there a need for it? My favorite, though, of course, is, you know, you're going to create an app and make billions of dollars off of it. So that would be the easiest way. No startup costs and just need help
exactly.
Getting the word out.
How big of a role does family play in all of this, extended family, in terms of one's own financial stability? Or either A, obviously, if you're an entrepreneur, you might borrow money, but more likely, there might be some financial support or at least moral support in terms of whatever your finances are. Anybody?
You know, it's such a personal conversation and decision to make, because what I would do, somebody else might not do. My husband and I, we try to support our daughters in any way we can. One, because of our own path, and we know it wasn't even an option. We couldn't go to our parents and say, can we borrow $10,000 to start a business? Or can we borrow, you know, some money towards a down payment for a house? It wasn't even an option. So for me and for my husband, I think it's because we did not have that and we're in a place where we can do that, it means the world to us to be able to help set them up for success. It has limitations. We have boundaries, but the fact that we can do it, it's important to us.
Is it ever good to borrow money from a family member?
Well, if I could, I probably would have, but it wasn't an option.
You know, it's interesting because one of the workshops that we had was actually a breakout on having a conversation with family members about money, and the person teaching it is a social worker, because there's all the dynamics of what happens when you bring in family members. And this is not my area of expertise, but I will say is that sometimes you can have conversations with complete strangers that are more in depth than you can have with your family members. Mm-hmm. And I asked a social worker why that was. And she said, because we have a history with our family. Mm-hmm. We have a history. And we remember when my little sister, we were 8 and 9 years old, and she did something to me, and I still remember that 30, 40, 50 years later. You know, so we carry this history with us that impacts the conversations that we have with family members. I've heard advice from, you know, borrowing money from family members of don't do it, to do it if you have a plan, or only do it if you can afford to lose that money. And not, but again, that's not my area.
I think at the end of the day, it's a values question. You know, it's what is important. It's what's important to you. I have friends who, I don't loan money. I don't do business with family. It's a hard and fast rule. And then I know others that if they can help, you know, a young person, or if they can help somebody in need, there's usually, you know, boundaries associated with it, right? Or stipulations, they'll do it.
Yeah.
So I think it's a values question.
So Don, would you lend money to a family member?
I was actually expecting them to do it the other way around, but that's another. But let me ask you this. So would one recommend that if indeed they were going to borrow money from a family member, that they draw up some kind of contractual agreement, that they really set this thing down in hard and paper, as so there's no wiggle room here?
I would say it's a good idea. I would say that it depends on the amount of money, the terms that are expected, but I would say having that legally drawn up could save some emotional issues through the way and some heartache at the end. So I would say having an attorney involved in that could be beneficial.
In terms of retirement, how significant is it that we've seemed to shift now from defined pension benefits, which actually I happen to be a recipient of, as opposed to, say, 401ks, which are not? What kind of impact has that had? Because, you know, like, for instance, in the old days, there was a union. Matter of fact, I was after a defined pension. They're going to give you X number of dollars month after month after month until the day you die, mm-hmm. as opposed to a 401k, which is actually your own money, or perhaps a combination, which is really more of a savings than anything else.
Or a cash balance fund.
Yeah, or cash, right,
where
right.
You're, instead of a traditional pension, the money goes into the cash balance fund, and now you're responsible for managing that.
Right,
a lot
exactly.
of companies are moving in that direction.
So you're asking what the difference, the impact on the future?
Yeah, I mean... Because not having, for instance, not having a defined benefit is something that's much different than, say, if you're trying to save. And if you're trying to save, which like the 401k, you may not save as much money to give you that kind of defined, mm-hmm. what the defined benefit would be. I mean,
not many people have the benefit any longer of having a pension, mm-hmm. a secure stream of income. So a portfolio should be developed with that in mind. If a constant stream of income is not provided in any other way, how can we provide that?
Mm-hmm. Is it important then to say, when we talk about diversity, that the down the road you want to, like, have, say, stocks that have got dividends, that kind of thing, if you're concerned about that then?
So a quality portfolio. We need time in order to be able to get to our goal. We need quality investments, so do some research on that. Make sure that they're quality. And then we also need a diversified portfolio, and I think that's what you're getting to. We don't want all of our eggs in one basket or one sector of the market or one specific investment. We need a plan which incorporates many different kinds of things. Our money may be working in different ways and have different account objectives in order to be able to get there. But the portfolio itself should have a plan at the end of, you know, how are we going to distribute or make this plan work for our retirement. But there are many moving parts within that portfolio.
How do you see that portfolio changing over time as you move towards retirement?
Well, it depends on the person's age. It also depends on how comfortable they are with the volatility of the stock market. It also depends on how educated they are and if they are seeking advice. So that's going to look different for everyone on their individual basis. But I would say, in general, as you get closer to retirement, your portfolio becomes more conservative, ensuring that it's going to last throughout your retirement.
So in terms of retirement, people would like to say that they'd like to retire or age in place, I guess is the term that's of art that's being used. How likely is that, given the fact that we have so many people who probably not saving enough, As we mentioned a moment ago, women's Social Security tends to be less over time. How realistic is it, particularly for women, that they will age in place? Anybody?
Age in place meaning stay mm-hmm. at home and mm-hmm. be able to maintain. Well, that's an important part of the planning that I do because many people don't think about long-term care insurance or long-term care protection, and that can be devastating on finances. I have many elderly women as clients, a lot of which are widows, and they didn't plan for that. And that can be very difficult. But there are solutions you can plan for as long-term care insurance. But I would say if you have family members that are willing to be able to, you know, stop work or take some time off of work to be able to help you, great. If you don't want to be an imposition, then create a plan. What happens when, you know, when and if I get to the point where I can't care for myself any longer and I may need some assistance because it's likely to happen.
Right. And I think age in place also, again, going back to the family house, age in place doesn't mean that you're still in the family house. It might mean that you downsize into a townhouse, a condo, something that is easier to maintain so you don't have the expenses of putting a new roof on your, you know, over your head. So really thinking about, again, the plan and saying, if then, if this happens to me, then what are my options? What are my choices? Again, you know, as I keep saying, taking charge of your future, but really it goes back to individual accountability. We can't wait for someone to come and say, this is what's going to happen to you. If you're lucky, my mom lived by herself in an apartment until she passed away at age 90. But she also had my, sisters that would come over and clean her apartment once a week, go grocery shopping for mm-hmm. her, other siblings that would take her to doctor's appointment. I think she was one of the lucky ones where she had the opportunities.
Yeah, I mean, I had my situation with my own parents where they lived in a condo and everything, but they certainly needed a lot of oversight in terms of pills and that kind of thing and making sure that they'd make all the doctor's appointments and so on. What kind of role does Medicaid play in all this as you get older? Ooh. That's like, because I ran into some
show.
Of that.
That's a different show.
I ran into that question, even though I didn't have to deal with it. But I mean, Medicaid doesn't deal with long-term care and that kind of thing.
Let me just say this from my own personal experience. I feel like I'm still trying to understand the language of Medicaid. It's like a different language. And I got thrown into that lane with my mom. And it was overwhelming. So what I would say is you really have to educate yourself about what it is. I was forced to learn it while in a crisis, which makes it 10 times worse.
Because, and how did you learn about it?
On the fly. I mean,
where did you go to?
Well, to Medicaid, you know, offices and speaking to representatives and to social worker at the assisted living facility that she was in. My sister's in medical billing. She's been in that field for 20 years, so thank God she was able to help interpret a lot of things for me. But it's a very overwhelming thing to have to navigate when you're uneducated about it.
Mm. What kind of role do you think that Medicare plays when you get older? Obviously, you kick in. I mean, you got the supplemental stuff and so on.
It could play a very, very big role, especially if you don't have any other insurance, like if that's all that you're relying on. And then there's so many limitations to it. That the whole healthcare conversation is very overwhelming and depressing to me.
We talk about it in every appointment. It is a game changer.
Yeah.
Do you have it? What do you have? What is it going to look like in the mm-hmm. future? Am I going to have to rely on Medicaid in my mm-hmm. future? Although I have Medicare now, will I be able to maintain, or am I going to be relying on Medicaid in the future? So,
and knowing the difference between the two.
Right.
Medicaid and Medicare and Part A, B, C, and D.
There's a lot of confusion.
Yeah.
But I think that healthcare conversation is just as important as the financial conversation, as the protection conversation of what is healthcare going to cost in the future. And I'm not sure anybody can give a clear direction.
Or
on
what
that
it
one.
Look like, I suppose,
right.
for that matter, right?
What it looks like is even more important.
And we will not know. But it does. I mean, but you know, for people who are retiring, that's going to be a key component, amongst other things, not only like where you stay and that kind of thing, right. but also for people to take care of you or to deal with your needs. What can you plan for? Especially since you don't really, and since you, A, obviously, as you mentioned a moment ago, you don't really know what it's going to look like from the governmental standpoint, but you also do not know what it's going to look like for you personally, medically.
You know, this isn't an area that I'm an expert on, but yeah. I think that you really do need to just keep on being aware of what's happening, you know, read the newspapers, go to different sites, and just keep informed as things are changing. One of the things that I learned when you did your seminar last summer was that there are four different things that everyone should have. And I was wondering if you could say a little bit about that, because it was the will, power mm-hmm. of attorney, mm-hmm. which absolutely mm-hmm. surprised me.
And a medical, advanced directive, medical
advanced
directive.
Yeah.
That's those basically the estate plan incorporates those three items. And I'm not an estate planning attorney. I don't claim to have all of that knowledge. Yeah. However, I do work closely with those professionals. And I'm aware of the situations where those three documents are very important as part of the estate planning process.
And what are the differences between the three then? The will obviously says this is where my money goes to.
Right.
And then the medical directive will say this is what happens to my body personally. But then the power of attorney.
That gives someone permission in order to be able to act on your behalf, whether that's financially, medically. Those
I
kinds
have that
of things.
For my mom, yeah.
So
yeah.
As far as, you know, your will can be really important part of your estate plan for some people, and other people it doesn't really make any difference. They may have beneficiaries designated on all of their different accounts that mm-hmm. nothing may make it to the will. But in a lot of circumstances, those three documents are really important as far as a legacy for your family.
Mm-hmm. And you indicated a moment ago that you went something similar with your mother. Tell me about what that experience was like as she finally got older. And
so my mom is physically challenged from the waist down, and so when I discovered that, and it's something that started happening kind of gradually, but then it just escalated within a short period of time where she wasn't mobile, and so I had to get power of attorney. I had to meet with her doctors and know who they were and understand what was happening in her treatment. I had to figure out what insurance she had, Medicaid, Medicare, and how they worked together or didn't work together. Move her from her apartment, which was a senior citizen building, into an assisted living facility. And it was overwhelming. It was overwhelming because I was devastated that she was in this condition, this physical condition. She was always very independent and self-sufficient my whole life. And then all of a sudden now she was disabled and she couldn't take care of herself. And so I had to deal with the emotion of that, along with caring for, making sure that she was getting the best treatment possible for what coverage she had, and that she was in the best facility possible. That's another whole discussion, is the state of affairs with our facilities that care for our senior citizens in this country. I don't know what happens outside the U.S., but here, it's even if you're paying top dollar, even if they are five-star facilities, you're still dealing with quality care issues for elderly. So all of that rolled up into one. Had me on the verge of a nervous breakdown because I was doing all of this alone and I wasn't really educated about what I was dealing with, which is why I say education is so important. Even if you're not there and you're not even thinking about being there, it's better to have that knowledge and wisdom before you have to execute on it.
Do you think as a woman and women in general, do they generally then get the responsibility for taking care of these things?
Well, I certainly got it.
and I had a friend who said she moved back to her hometown because her daughter was there and she knew her daughter would take care of her and her son wouldn't. But I think statistically, the number of it's women spend 12. Let's see, I'm looking at my numbers. They spend 12 years out of the paid workforce, more than 12 years than men do, taking care of both children and elderly parents. And often they're taking care of maybe not just their parents, but their in-laws. So, you know, this is the only statistics I had came from, it looks like advisorperspective.com that had this information. But yes, I think that a lot of women you know, anecdotally, we hear of the women taking care of the parents more often.
And I used to hear this term, the sandwich generation, mm-hmm. and not really paying much attention to what that meant until I became a sandwich. And it's like, okay, I get it now. Like, right. I was literally wedged in between, you know, I was working full-time. I had a very vibrant full-time career. I still had children that I was responsible for, even though they had gotten up, you know, they were in junior high school, and then I had my mom. And so it was very overwhelming.
And I know that the number of, when you think about caretaking, the number of people you're taking care of as the elderly people is the same as the younger people. So put in a different way, women are taking care of just as many elderly family members as children. And so it really mm-hmm. is coming from both sides.
Mm-hmm. Also, I want to raise the issue about women of color. Do they have it worse, do you think, as opposed to white women? I mean, do they start out at behind in terms of finances? What do you think? I don't know. But I'm just popping this question out to you, so you can take it.
I have to be very careful how I answer this question.
The research I've seen has, if you look at what the wages that women of color make, it's less than right. white women.
So I was going to say, that requires a real, like, that requires a holistic response, right? Because there's so many things that are connected mm-hmm. that impact women of color before we even get to this part of the conversation. Right. So, you know, equity in pay, opportunities, you know, fair treatment, et cetera. There are those differences. We can't hide those. They're real. And so when you think about retirement, being able to retire, taking care of a family member and children, et cetera, there's just so much that goes into answering a question like that because of the dirty word disadvantage. You know, there's so many disadvantages that women of color have to deal with. I'm in the diversity and inclusion space because I actually have an interest and a passion for that. And my approach is, how do we get beyond having the diversity, equity, belonging, and inclusion conversation to actually manifesting it? You know, how do we shift from talking about it, having strategies, planning, think tanks, mastermind groups, to actually doing it and actually seeing the manifestation of all of these conversations and research and, you know, statistics and all of that stuff.
So how are you empowering the young students that you're working with?
Empowering them to focus, to be leaders, really. That's my focus, is to be leaders. I would love to see more women and especially our youth that are in college having the opportunity to develop themselves as leaders. And it's not something that's always available. It's not always a part of a curriculum. You know, there's not a leadership development program all of the time, just like there's not always a diversity and inclusion program. So I get invited to speak all over Salisbury University to our resident assistants, our area directors, our business school students, liberal arts students, and that's what I love about what I do. And I always try to bring the two topics together, leadership and what diversity, equity, belonging, and inclusion is all about. There's so many terms that are being, terminology, so much terminology that's being used today, but what does that really mean? And I think it's an important conversation for leaders, but it's something that we all have to be at the table discussing and identifying strategies that we can collaborate to implement.
But I think there's a lot of opportunities on campus that allow students to step into their leadership. There's student groups.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. I think you just have to understand that self-leadership is going to be a critical skill for you to have moving forward.
And what does self-leadership mean?
It means being able to lead yourself. It means being able to know what your strengths are,
yeah, sure.
Know the areas that you need to develop, and being able to leverage those strengths.
Just quickly, in less than a minute, are you optimistic that young people are getting that message, that they're be taking responsibility for their finances and so on? I mean,
I do. I think so. I think students are engaged. I think they're interested. I think it's all how you position it. I think it's how you engage them in the conversation. And I think it's the tools that you provide them to be able to do that independently.
Well, we've been speaking with Jessica Eisman. She's the financial advisor for Area Women Inclusion Leader at Edward Jones. Also, Annette Johnson, a women's leadership coach and author, and has joined Salisbury University's Office of Diversity and Inclusion. And Mary Angela Baker, director of the Center for Extended and Lifelong Learning. Appreciate you all taking the time and spending time to talk about this, I think, important issue.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.